Welcome to the Maya on Money podcast, where we discuss all things money, because after all, money matters. Now, to my listeners, it has been a while since the last Maya on Money podcast, because for those of you who follow me, I've been very busy with Money, It's Not Black or White series with Mapalo Maku. So I hope you've been listening and following to that conversation. But there was something I really wanted to talk about this week, and that is medical schemes, because earlier this week in News 24, I wrote about a case where a father had gone to court to try and get his medical scheme to provide life-saving drugs for his son. And this case highlights the real challenges we face when it comes to medical care, because these new innovative medications that are saving lives are coming in at price tags in the millions. I mean, in this particular case, it would cost the scheme $6.2 million a year. Who should be paying for this? So joining me today is Tonisha Naidu. He is CEO of the Health Funders Association, which represents medical schemes. And they've been doing some work around the prescribed minimum benefit costs, the general burden on medical schemes, issues with the current legislation, and, you know, maybe how can we do this better? How can we bring down the cost? So welcome. Looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you, Maya. It's always a privilege. And thank you so much. I'm looking forward to it as well.
So let's start off with the elephant in the room. I know you are about to present some deep research that you've done across the members. And just in terms of what medical schemes are paying out in terms of prescribed minimum benefits, maybe just give us a little bit of insight into this, into these numbers.
Sure. You know, I think firstly, most important thing is what is actually PMBs. So PMBs is actually, is prescribed minimum benefits. And I must say, it's actually a minimum package that every medical scheme member, you know, has access to and must be funded. And they cover 271 specified diagnosis and treatment pairs, DTPMBs, and 26 chronic conditions. So, you know, for a simplistic case, it could be diabetes, you know, or if you get a heart attack, etc. But it's not as simple as that, right? It's such a complex package, because it depends entirely, PMB depends on what diagnosis you have, what treatments are required, what protocols are. So what used to be a very simple kind of, you know, analysis is actually quite a complex thing. And this actually comes perhaps to the crux of it. You know, PMB is by law is what medical schemes have to pay for and covered for. And this was constituted with the Medical Schemes Act, you know, of 1998, you know, actually back then, in fact. Unfortunately, while the Medical Schemes Act says that the PMB package must be updated, you know, every 2 years, sadly, it's not been done. And what the PMB package was back then, if you think fast forward to today, right, we've got so many new treatments, robotic treatments, we've got biologic medicines, immunotherapies, and a number of high-cost treatments. And simply, the framework of 20, 30 years ago is just not fit for purpose for today. And if you take a step back, right, medical schemes fundamentally is not for profit. It might actually sound crazy, but medical schemes are not for profit. They actually owned by the members. And what actually happens is members contribute every month. And towards that contribution, that pot of money goes towards paying healthcare claims. And PMBs is a way to kind of say, okay, for that money, what should we be paying? But the tricky part, right, is, and it's always particularly, you know, with some of these cases, and I think the case you mentioned is, medical schemes would love to pay for everything. We would love to pay for every healthcare, but there's only a finite pot of money, right? And I think sometimes how I try to explain it, if you had 1 million rand, right, and that 1 million rand, you had a choice. Do I treat 1,000 children on a preventative vaccine or something? Or do I use that 1 million rand for one person? And it becomes a really ethical challenge. Obviously, it's very, you know, subjective depending on who the person is. But medical schemes has a duty now to look after the collective, and that's where the trade-offs come in. So when we hear these cases of 6.4 million rand, right, it becomes quite a tricky situation because you know that person needs funding, but it also means that it has to be taken away from a different pot. It could be preventative, and it could be, I mean, one interesting stat which we came out from our State of Medical Schemes report is we interviewed roughly, we got data back from about 5.8 million medical scheme lives, right? And 17, only 17% of that, just under a million lives, actually had higher claims than their contributions, right? So that means the other 83% were cross-subsidizing at 17%. And that's how medical schemes work. Roughly 80% or 83%, they claim less than they are. Their surplus goes to actually take care of the people that are sickly and so on. But you know, the problem and challenge is it can only go so far because we've got a limited pool around. And it's far more complex than that.
Oh, and I want to get back to that because I want to get back to the way that schemes are structured. I have been covering this for 23 years. So I remember all of the risk equalization funds that were promised, the updates to PMB. So I want to discuss to the extent that legislation has let us down and regulation is letting us down. But before we go there, you mentioned, and I think this is quite an important point, that schemes are not for profit. Because whenever people are complaining about their medical scheme not paying, they point to a certain health fund scheme up in Sandton with its big offices. And the worst thing they could have done was build those offices and says, look, they are making money. So I think it's important to understand that there is an administrator. And about, if I remember last time, about 8% of our premiums go to costs. So that is, so if I'm spending 1,000 rand a month, of that 80 rand is going to the administrator. And that's where the profit-making machine would sit. But that is still only leaving me with, my maths is correct, eh? So it is 80 rand for 1,000 rand. So that means that the remainder is going into the pool, and it is that pool from which we pay. And I think schemes are running at about a solvency rate across the board of about 96%. Am I correct? I'm not solvency rate, claims rate on the pool. Did you have those figures? Is that about right?
So exactly. So I think I'm going to make it a little bit more simpler. So let's assume for every 100 grand, right? You know, 8 rand goes towards the administration costs, and that you understand is for your call centers. You know, people actually doing the transactions. You know, your statements, the rent, etc. But you know, 92 odd rand or so goes towards actually paying funding healthcare claims. And that's actually, you know, what it should be around. And that's ex really good in terms of it. The challenge we have every year, though, is that 100 rand, right, goes, if your salary goes up by 5%, which means, you know, unfortunately, medical schemes goes up from by 10, let's say, you know, CPI plus 3 to 4%. So let's say it's 100 rand this year. Next year, it could be 110 rand. And it's above what your salary increase. And the reason, unfortunately, and this is why it becomes such a challenge for affordability, it's not profit that's actually driving this. What we have, and unfortunately, is we've got 9 million South African beneficiaries, right? Unfortunately, because of the incomplete regulatory system, we have a voluntary, which is voluntary membership. So people decide when they want to join. Now, typically, if you're a youngster and you know you've got to spend a few thousand odd rand, you know, say 2,500 rand, do I spend 2,500 rand on healthcare or do I spend 2,500 rand on a car or a cell phone? And typically, you know, unfortunately and sadly, it's instant gratification that we've come to see, and people rather prefer it, you know, on disposable income rather than that. So the young and healthy, who actually cross-subsidize, call it that 17%, are becoming less and less. And what you have is over the years, we've got an aging population of the 9 million. And if you think about it for your viewers, et cetera, when you are young and fit, you know, you could almost be hit by a bus the next day, be up and walking, right? The older you get, you've got chronic issues, diabetes, hypertension, all these things. If you're in your 60s and so on, it's you actually, if you have an injury, it takes much longer. And you need more healthcare services. You need to go see more doctors, more medication. And that increase in healthcare is just going up and up and up. And it's the utilization that's driving, the 10%. From it. So more people needing more help getting older. And then unfortunately, until we are able to, complete, close those regulatory loops, and I can call it the following, number one is probably we've talked about it. We need to review the PMDs. It's 20 years, past due dates, if I can put it that way, number one. Number two, is the other incomplete thing is mandatory membership. Now, mandatory membership is if you're employed, we've got a number of people, and we've done a bit of an analysis, for this. If we actually did the following, if we actually took everyone that was formerly employed but did not join medical schemes, and we are talking a significant number of people, it's possibly, an additional 9 million South Africans that could belong to the population. The cost of medical aid could, reduce between 18 to 25%. Now that's a big range, 18 to 25%. It's what shows you the issue of voluntary membership is. It's only the sick are joining, and when you get sick, you join. Maternity is a great example, actually. People actually stay out. And when they want to get, want to start having families and so on, then they join medical scheme because potentially you could have a higher claim. And we've seen it, one of the other parts of our medical scheme is the highest neonatal claim was 9.9 million rand for last year. And by law, by part of the PMB package, that has to be covered. So typically what we see, right, and not in that case, members would join medical schemes, have the baby under medical scheme. If everything's all good, no issues, then they simply leave medical schemes, right? And then that actually becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because it's now we've lost those potential positive, contributions. So that's the one. And the other one, which is the Risk Equalization Fund. The issue and challenge we have right currently at this point in time is because we don't have mandatory membership and we don't have risk equalization fund, all medical schemes are competing for the young and healthy lives because you want them to be joining for you. So it reduces your overall claims. And because of that, each medical scheme is now competing for the young and healthy. So a medical scheme, what typically happens across the globe, and I talk about, countries like Netherlands, Australia, and a number of, I think there's probably about 20 odd countries around the world that have employed risk equalization fund. It looks at each scheme and profile and say, okay, look, you've got an older age population here. You're therefore going to be claiming more, right? And this scheme B has a younger population. We need to equalize that. So you are competing on service levels and not competing for lives, for attracting lives. You're competing on quality and everything that should be there, not on trying to attract young and healthy lives. So what they do is the younger scheme pays towards what they call a risk equalization fund, a certain contribution, and the recipients of that is the older medical scheme fund. They receive that from the risk equalization fund, and it's never been implemented in South Africa. And we believe, preliminary kind of estimates is we could do this, and it would mean about 5.6 billion rand being transferred, between various between the entire industries that would be flowing between the various schemes. Now, 5.6 billion rand might seem a lot, but currently, annual contributions is about 260 billion rand. So we're talking about 3 to 4% is going to be transferred between schemes around it. So that is, what part of the work we want to do, a what if scenario, what if we did do this? and then leave it out there. Obviously, this requires, political intervention, willpower, and so on to implement these reforms. But it
Well,
is,
I'm going to throw in the, I'm going to say what what's probably the truth, and that is the reason none of this has happened. And we can also a little bit talk about the low cost benefit options, which is, I think I've been writing about for 15 years, never been implemented. So we know prescribed minimum benefits was are supposed to be updated every 2 years. We know that the Risk Equalization Fund was part of the original Medical Schemes Act that was envisaged at the time that that act came into place. I remember all of these things. And we've got all of these challenges that the regulators have not done. And the reason they haven't done it is because of NHI. Because they're saying, why do we need to do all of this? Because we don't really want successful medical schemes. We want to transfer everybody, because all of this will be solved with NHI. Because with NHI, it is a national insurance, it is mandatory membership. It is naturally equalized, risk equalized, because everybody's part of it. And so, actually, why do we need to update anything to the medical schemes?
Yeah, sure. So I think, firstly, HFA, we're a voice for the medical schemes. And I think, we are firstly and foremost all for universal health coverage, which is the ultimate goal, right? And we've been having engagements and discussions, I can tell you, since the Green Paper, and many around NHI. And we are, one of the legal challenges to the NHI for a number of reasons. One, firstly, we're not against UHC, we're just against the model that the NHI has. What they've put onto the table, unfortunately, is so unique that it's not anywhere else in the world we see it. It's financially going to bankrupt South Africa. It means doubling taxes to the 7-odd million South Africans we have. So it's financially impossible. And unfortunately, amongst many other issues and challenges. But our view and perspective is, there is a unique path. And we've put a model on the table because our perspective is we have deeply divided public and private healthcare systems in terms of quality. We have, for all intents and purposes, probably one of the best private healthcare systems in the world. And if you ask anyone in the private healthcare system, they're willing to roll up their sleeves and make this work because we believe in our country. And one of the way we believe is we should have one common benefit package for all 63 million South Africans of basic private healthcare. Now, I'll come back to that in a second, but just coming back to the NHI, from the perspective of, yes, I've heard that many, many times of NHI is going to be the utopia and it's going to solve everything. But I think just to maybe a few pointers here. Firstly, even coming from the minister's legal papers, he declared in his affidavit, NHI will be at least 10 to 15 years away. So NHI is not a solution for tomorrow. It is something that is 10 to 15 years. So the question is, what do we do now? Our healthcare system is in, a serious concern, particularly the public sector. And for us, this is what we have been advocating for, is what can we do for the people now? Now, let me take you back to understand. While we have 9 million South Africans in a private healthcare sector, data, from international recognized universities like UCT and so on have said that it's actually up to 40% of South Africans use private healthcare sector. So we have, call it 25 million South Africans using private healthcare sector, not just 9 million. The challenge is that 16 million additional are going to private healthcare and paying cash. Now, that is the most regressive form of healthcare funding anywhere in the world. And that's, from the WHO or something. Now, what we want to do, and it's been written about, 10, 15 years ago from what we call low-income medical scheme, it's a PMPM package that offers primary healthcare. And we've done the numbers, we've kind of said, we can offer as medical schemes through an exemption process or, under medical schemes, offer a primary healthcare package that offers you unlimited GPs, nurse-led consultations, essential medicine list, basic radiology, pathology, HIV, etc., for 400 rand a month per person.
So is this the low
And
cost benefit option? So if we had to talk about a
correct.
low cost benefit, which the schemes have been working on for a long time, it's just waiting for the Council of Medical Schemes to approve it. Yeah.
Exactly. So this is it. We're ready to, if I can put it this way, we're ready to rock and roll. We need, the political approval to go. And in fact, and it's not the case of, renewables. There are actually five exempt medical schemes which offer this. Sorry, this is what I said.
So you're talking about being able to offer all of that for 400 rand a month. Now, I do, by the way, I have to tell you, my sons are on one of the student packages. I think we pay 600 rand a month, and that includes private hospitalization. So yes, these things are possible, if there are certain limits to them.
So absolutely, you're fundamentally right. So what we've done right is the analysis. So for 400 rand, right, we've done the analysis. There are approximately 10.2 million South Africans who earn between 7,000 rand and 30,000 rand a month who are employed, who could actually purchase this and be able to get primary health care cover from. It's hospital, doesn't, sorry, excludes hospital. But for us, as I was saying, there are five key medical schemes that have PMB exempt packages, and they are key economic sectors. So, to give you an idea, we have, in the fishing industry, fish med. We've got in the food industry, food med. We've got in the transport, which is motor health. We've got golden arrows, and we've got the building construction thing. And they offer PMB exempt packages from 160 rand a month. And that's because we're listening. But essentially, what we want to do, primary healthcare is the building blocks of any healthcare system around the globe. We can, one, by doing this, we can enable, access to private healthcare for those 10.2 million South Africans. Number two, I think it's important, and I've spoken about, if this is done under the Medical Schemes Act, technically, those members could get access to the tax credit, the medical tax credit. So you're now reducing your 400 rand less 374 rand. So you're paying about what, 36 rand for this from it. But the additional benefit, and if you look from an economic perspective, what you're doing is you're actually allowing those members to take care of their healthcare. So they have the private. What resources are left then can be used for the public sector. So the poor and vulnerable can actually, you reduce the pressure, the queuing, the stock outs, etc., that we're currently experiencing. So for us, we view this as a pathway to universal health coverage while we're waiting for NHI from that side of things.
Okay, so it sounds a little bit like health insurance, what you're offering. So, which already exists. So many people are on health insurance, and we're seeing that a lot of people moving away from medical schemes because they can't afford it to health insurance. And the big differentiator with health insurance, it doesn't cover hospitals and it doesn't cover PMBs. So how is this different from what we currently have?
Sure. So I think, it's a little bit of a story, but about 10 years ago almost, right, there was always the intention to introduce kind of low-cost benefit options. And in parallel, while this was the intention was there, many circulars by the regulator, they started up health insurance, that was done under a short-term life insurance product. And considering that, there was issues around who actually should be doing this, they came under a framework for a demarcation regarding, okay, health should then go into kind of CMS space, health insurance, and there was granted a 2-year exemption with the intention that health insurance moves into medical scheme space with the existence or creation of LCBO. And I must say, we've now, what are we, on the fifth exemption. So every 2 years since then, it's been extended. The next exemption expires March 2027. My view and perspective is, I don't think there's a plan in place, so we may see a sixth exemption coming up. Now, there are approximately, now where we actually see and what's actually happened in this vacuum where, medical schemes were not allowed to offer LCBOs, low cost benefit options, we saw the rise and increase of these health insurance products. And there's approximately, from 500,000 in 2017, there's probably around 1.5 to 2 million policies out there. Now, for me, firstly, they do serve a purpose. They're providing access. They show us there's a market need for it. There's a demand for it. There are challenges because what happens come April, 2027, employers have bought these for the employees because it increases, the security, the productivity. You make sure your employee is there. It helps the business. But, we need certainty. We need regulatory certainty. We need, in my view, a more policy view. And I think for us, we are asking, we're continuously asking with the regulators, you've allowed, insurance products to continue, and you've handcuffed medical schemes, and has unfortunately led to more and more sustainability issues and affordability issues. Can you take the handcuffs off and at least let us compete from that perspective? I think that's what we were asking for.
Okay, so I mean so one of the solutions, if I had to wave, if I could, if I was the Council of Medical Schemes, if I was the health minister, and you came to me with your wish list, what would you like to see in the short term happening that you believe will benefit members, bring down the costs of premiums, and improve outcomes?
Sure. So I think, let me start with, and this comes back to our PO, Voice of the PO survey. I think there were kind of four key things, and maybe five key things, that the principal officers, at the coalface of this have asked for. Number one, modernize PMBs. We need this PMB reform. Let's look at the package. Let's update it so we can understand the right protocols, so we can budget properly, and we don't have those issues. Number one. Number two, enable low cost benefit options. We need that. There is a market, there's a demand, the data shows it. We know up to 40% are using already private healthcare. Let's just make this product work. Number three, strengthen risk pooling. So it is risk equalization and mandatory membership, which we've talked about and explained. Number four, I think for it is improved provider cost regulation. So what that means is clearer tariff guidelines, reference pricing for PMBs and non-PMBs. We didn't quite touch on this, but by law, it's covered in regulations that if it's a PMB, it must pay at full cost. Right, PMBs must be paid in full. Now, obviously, there's some caveats around there, which is we have to pay if it's you don't have reasonable access to a DSP, a designated service provider, and the way to manage these PMB costs is through networks and DSPs. So, however, there is coming out from the Health Market Inquiry, that report that came out in, I'd say, oh, was it 2019 as such, regarding a multilateral negotiating forum where we can sit down and negotiate prices for, PMB packages, because that could help and assist with affordability, predictability, and risk. So I think that's number four, in very broad strokes. And then I think fundamentally, underpinning all of this is we just need a coherent regulatory framework. How do we actually go about this? I think we're to be honest, NHA uncertainty, this exemption process for LCB, I mean for demarcated products every 2 years, and the LCBO not being defined, etc., just creates uncertainty. We need regulatory. So I think those four things packaged into a proper framework and pathway, I think, are the five things, that we've heard from our peers in this message from them.
And I want to go back to the reference price list because it used to exist many years ago, I remember, and they decided it was anti-competitive, which kind of then actually prevented exactly that. Some sort of, even as a consumer, I don't have any idea what a doctor can charge me or what a medication should cost. And there used to be this reference price list so that you could at least know that this what a reasonable amount to pay is. So I couldn't agree with you more. I think that was not anti. I think it was the opposite. I think it enabled consumers to have the information they required to make good decisions. And I think that going back to some sort of price reference list. But I also wanted to touch back on the PMBs, because the prescribed minimum benefits, this is always the issue, and this is exactly the case I was writing about, is you have to cover, if it is a PMB, which in this boy's case it is, that's undisputed, it must be paid in full. You have a biologic drug that is 6.2 million rand a year, it must be paid in full. That's one part of how to interpret PMBs. But the industry has kind of come up with another interpretation, or just an allowed interpretation, which is it needs to be available in public healthcare. So that's now your reference point. Your reference point is not whatever pharmaceutical companies come out to market with. It's, is it publicly available? And if it is publicly available, then we will cover it. And in these new biologic drugs, you can imagine they are not available in state hospital. So maybe just want to comment a little bit on that as well. And how would you want to see the reform around PMBs going forward? So we're not A, working with this sort of loose interpretation, but also perhaps providing guidelines around life-saving drugs that are carrying millions and millions price tag.
Sure. And I must say, this is a very complex subject to try and get through in 2 minutes, but I'll try. Okay. So firstly, I think, it comes back to the point of, we would love to pay for everything, right? But we only have a limited pot of money. So we've got to be able to provide guidelines and, some sort of rules to be able to do so. And that allows us to be able to have multiple different pricing packages around it from rules and protocols. You should not expect to buy, let's say, the base package, and expect to then be able to afford the most expensive treatment around it. And that just doesn't work anyway. It's similar to kind of explaining it. You buy a airplane ticket, you get a economy class ticket, and you expect to be able to get into first class. And that's to some extent, it's the type of, yeah. What we do try to do, and I think this has come about, not us, I think the regulator has put in, consideration. Within what we have, we can't afford everything. We need to be able to provide guidelines. They said for PMBs, medical schemes should be able to cover at least what is offered instead. So it's PMB level of cover. And that was the guiding mantra, and is the guiding mantra to today around it. So if it's available in state, under certain conditions, et cetera, and when you say available in state, as in procured, not donated to state, it must be purchased by state, then we can cover it as medical scheme. Now,
From the lowest plan
unfortunately,
onwards, it would be covered by the lowest plan.
general. But you can have certain exclusions, of course, like biologics is excluded on the lowest end plan, and that's left up to, schemes and scheme rules and such. The problem or challenge comes back to, in these 20 odd years, we never had biologics when PMBs were started. We now have biologics, and we have, I can tell you, if I go back to, for argument's sake, some of the data that's coming out of a state scheme report, the top five, medications from that 5.8 million range from 5.4 million up to, 7.4 million for biologic treatments, for rare diseases and for Pompe disease and Hunter syndrome, et cetera. And, we never had drugs back like that for 20 years ago. It was the system was never designed for it. So we unfortunately have a fracturing system, and we need to figure out collectively how we negotiate and forward. One of the considerations, is, and it's not to which needs further unpacking, is if we know there's a defined population, for call it a particular condition, as let's say it's 20,000 population, we should be able to maybe sit down with the pharmaceutical companies that offer it and say, look, you currently offer it at 1,000 rand for argument's sake. Can you bring this down to 500 rand? And because of our maybe we can go into some sort of NDA, right? So we don't have to disclose, because one of the issues we have is we have a great ACP, which is regulates medicine pricing, but we also have a very transparent pricing, and so whatever you kind of publish, then becomes your base for other countries. So many pharmaceutical companies are concerned about bringing drugs here, because it's published, the public price, etc. And then that becomes now lowers the price for other countries. Like Brazil is now using South Africa as a reference price point. So we need to change some of those medicine reforms. If we can bring the price down for those drugs, we can create access to more, right? Or cover more with lower co-payments. So those are some of the mechanics that need to be worked out, from that perspective. And that's maybe a wish list of part of maybe the multilateral negotiating forum, price, tariff negotiations, etc. So we aren't anywhere near close to it, but I think that's the pathway I'm talking about from a coherent regulatory framework.
I think what's frustrating for me, as a financial journalist, I work across so many different sectors, is legislation, regulation, legislation, regulation. The lack of it moving forward, the lack of it being enacted, is costing consumers an absolute fortune. And it is frustrating. I mean, I don't know what else to say. One can only hope maybe with some pressure on government, GNUs, all the rest of it, we'll start to see some changes going forward. But I wanted just to end off with a question on NHI, because it does rattle people. They are concerned about it. There is now phase two is now officially we're now officially into phase two. What does that mean? And what does it mean for somebody like myself paying who pay who is a member of a medical scheme?
Sure. So, as a person who's paying medical scheme, if I can put it this way, you don't have to worry about anything for the next 10 to 15 years. And that goes back to, mentioning a finding affidavit, that NHI is 10 to 15 years. I mean, a couple of things maybe to take back. As mentioned, HFA, has a legal case against the NHI, number one. And then earlier this year, it was February. The Minister of Health actually, and the President agreed, with HFN among a number of other applicants, one that NHI would actually the implementation would be paused pending the legal outcome of the public participation cases. So what's happening in the background isn't actually NHI implementation, it's actually health system strengthening. It's stuff that the country needs. And when I say health system strengthening, we need more hospitals, we need more doctors, we need an IT system, because it's ridiculous if you go from one province to the other and you've got to repeat everything you've got to say in terms of your health conditions, your bloods, etc. So we need an electronic health record. Those are, for me, it's been, call it, talked about as part of the NHI, but for me, it's stuff that still has to go ahead. We've got to make sure we got health systems through and the building blocks. NHI, call it phase two, was about bringing into law, the act, promulgating the or proclaiming the act. I forget between the two what's the correct word. And then two, constituting the board, putting the fund together. All of that is on pause. And that's what we've agreed to. But some people will say, "But yeah, but what about all the stuff here?" That stuff we need as a country. We need the IT system. We need the doctors, and we're fully behind those type of things. So for you as a consumer, as medical scheme, please stay in your medical scheme. Do not do anything radical. Medical scheme is your lifeline. For the employed. And I think rest assured, as a health fund association, we're an NPO, for all intents and purposes, we are your advocate. We are here to make sure that your medical schemes has a future coexisting, and I must say, coexisting along with the public sector. It's not a NHI or medical schemes, it's NHI and medical schemes. And we will make sure we create a sustainable path for all 63 million South Africans.
Well, I think this has been such an interesting conversation, and I think it's really given a good framing for where we are at the moment. And I think, I think for a lot of consumers, they get confused as to how their scheme works. They get confused to what all these arguments are about. And I think you've laid them out really well. And I think you've also given us a little bit of a guideline on a way forward. Government willing. But is there access? I know you're issuing your report, your big survey. Is there a link that I can share with readers and followers?
Yes, it will be published tomorrow on our website, and probably at the symposium we'll probably put a QR code where you can download it as well.
Great.
So
So I'll
and then
definitely I'll just to note for those listening, I'll definitely have that link in the notes because I think it will be very interesting. I know you were mentioning to me before we started recording that I think the highest claim that a medical scheme paid out was last year was 20 over 20 million rand in a single claim. So
actually, I mean, if you just to explain to you, I think it was 20.7 million rand for a beneficiary over 65 years old, right? And I think just the maths behind it, right? Not everyone has 20 million rand sitting in their bank account. But just to give you an idea, it would have taken him 717 years of monthly contributions to be able to raise that 20 million rand, 717 years. Or, and this shows the power of social solidarity and, risk pooling. It takes 8,607 members' monthly contributions to cover that, provided they don't claim, right? So 8,600 members must not claim to cover that tw 20 million rand claim. So this shows you the value, of medical schemes and risk pooling.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. And thank you once again. I think it's been a really, really interesting conversation.
Great. Thank you so much, Maya. I loved it. And thank you so much to your viewers. Look forward to future engagements as well.